the death and resurrection of Lazarus. I've kind of divided this up a little bit into three sections. The first is going to be the preparation for the miracle, getting ready to see what Jesus has intended for this. And this is, again, written that John has recorded this so that our faith in Jesus will be strengthened, that he is the Messiah, he is God's Son. So we're going to start here. We're going to start in chapter 11, verse 1. I'm going to read the first 16 verses. It says, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. And it was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. The sisters therefore sent to him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.' But when Jesus heard it, he said, 'This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When therefore he heard that he was sick, he stayed then 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, 'Let us go up to Judea again.' The disciples said to him, 'Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?' Jesus answered, 'Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him.' This he said, and after that he said to them, 'Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go that I may awaken him out of the sleep.' The disciples therefore said to him, 'Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover.' Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he was speaking of literal sleep. Then Jesus therefore said to them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him.' Thomas, therefore, who was called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go, that we may die with him.'" So we see that Jesus is in a place, and it's at least a day's journey to from Bethany to where Jesus is at. I find something kind of interesting. Jesus says that this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified. Is there another place in John where something like this takes place, that something has happened, but it's not for us, what people might assume it is? Anybody have any ideas?
John 9.
John 9, the man born blind. And it's almost the same thing that Jesus says here. They ask him, he says, "And as he passed by, he saw a man born blind from birth," or a man blind born from birth. His disciples ask him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind?" But Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was in order that the works of God might be displayed in him." And so it's the same thing here with Lazarus. Lazarus was sick. Don't know what kind of a sickness it was, but Jesus tells him, "This sickness is not unto death." But then we see later, Jesus plainly tells him, "He's dead. He's no longer of this life." So there's a place there in which Jesus, again, for the purpose to produce faith in people that don't believe in Jesus, that these miracles, these signs would produce that type of faith. If you go down a little bit further, in verse 9, when Jesus says, and this is after, you know, we know that the Jews hate Jesus. And I was kind of struck by how many times John mentions the Jews. He doesn't say, you know, the Pharisees or anybody. He says it's the Jews that hate Jesus and that are trying to destroy him. In verse 9, Jesus says, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? And if anyone walks in the day, he doesn't stumble because he sees the light of this world." There was another place in which Jesus says practically the same thing about walking in the light, and that Jesus is in the light. And going back to chapter 9, right after he makes the statement that this man wasn't born blind because of sin, he says in verse 4 of chapter 9, he says, "We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no man can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." And that's what Jesus is telling them. There are things that we need to do now while we have the opportunity. And Jesus' mission here, gospel that he's preaching, shows that this is why he came into the world, to bring light for those who are in darkness. Thinking on Thomas's words, what he says to Jesus and to the other ones, he says, you know, they say to him, "Rabbi, the Jews are ready to kill you. And here you're going to go back to Jerusalem." And we find that Bethany is about a 2-mile separation from Jerusalem, that where Mary and Martha and Lazarus are at. So what do you think about what Thomas says here? You know, if he's going to go back there and maybe face death, I guess we're going to go back with him. Do you think it was, do you think he believed that they were really in the peril of being killed with Jesus, if Jesus was to go back? I think so. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, I've always wondered if Thomas might have been a little sarcastic here.
Oh, okay.
You know, I don't want to impugn motives, but you right. kind of wonder sometimes. If,
right.
You know, he's
right.
talking to disciples. I don't think you're necessarily saying this to Jesus, but.
Right.
But I don't know that's the case, but it just, you kind of wonder.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Bob.
I think it's interesting because they probably were ready to die with him, defending him, fighting with him, you know, doing. But when the end came and Jesus said, "Put down your sword."
Right.
They didn't know how to deal with that, and that's when they fled. Because
right.
they didn't know how to not die with him.
You're absolutely right. And that's how I kind of look at it, too. Just like when Peter says, "Lord, I'm willing to go to prison for you. I'm willing to die for you." And Jesus tells very plainly, you know, "You're going to deny me, Peter. Within a few hours, you're going to deny me." But you're right. You know, we get caught up in the passion and all, and we say, "I'll never deny you. I'll stick with you to the end." But we see, like in the garden, if it hadn't been for Jesus, they very easily could have been arrested and executed also. But Jesus protected them. Jesus made sure that he wasn't going to lose anyone other than the son of perdition that was already lost. But it is interesting when reading about how Didymus says to the Lord, you know, "Are you willing to go back there?" It's like, you know, why would you want to go back there when there's such hatred for you? But that's why Jesus says, "Because I got a mission to do here. I've got something to accomplish here." And I guess a lot of them still didn't quite understand that, what he was, because when he says it earlier about that the Son of Man is going to be, we're going to go up to Jerusalem and the Son of Man is going to be delivered over into the hands of evil men, and they're going to scourge him and they're going to crucify him and put him to death. And, oh gosh, that we can't have that. You know, that can't be. And, They still didn't quite understand what Jesus' mission was and why he was doing as he was doing. The statement that he stayed 2 days longer, like I said, it's about a day's journey to where he was at. He stays there 2 days, and then he comes back to Bethany, because from the record here we see that, you know, Lazarus has been dead 4 days. Any comments as to maybe why Jesus waited another 2 days there? As you know, why he would tarry. Anybody have any ideas or any? Yeah.
I think it's related to the fact that, you know, he wanted this event to glorify God, but also I think he waited a few days so that there would be absolutely no question at all as to whether Lazarus had actually died or not.
Earl, I agree with you 100%. I believe that is why Jesus did what he did. You know, there are two other incidents in which he raised someone from the dead. Does anybody remember those two? It's recorded in Luke. the widow's son of Nain, and then Jairus' daughter. I believe that's how his name is pronounced. Jairus' daughter. But those, as I have written here, it says, the decision to delay in coming did not bring about Lazarus' death, since Jesus already supernaturally knew what was going to happen to Lazarus. But most likely, the messenger arrived to inform Jesus that Lazarus was already, that when he did come, he was already dead. And that love that he had for Lazarus would be clear, because it greatly strengthened the faith of those who knew that Lazarus was dead. The delay also ensured that Lazarus had been dead long enough that no one could misinterpret the miracle as a fraud or mere resuscitation. And I agree. I think it was, he was dead. I mean, he was, and we know not only dead, but he was, had already been prepared for burial and put into the tomb and all. And we're going to see exactly where exactly, how they do the body and all. I found some things on what exactly they did when someone died. Let's see. I'm going to go on reading now. We see that Jesus is on his way now back to Bethany. So we're going to start in verse 17. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. And many of the Jews had come to Mary or to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary still sat in the house. Martha therefore said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother shall rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" In looking at this, Martha, of course, being upset, her brother's passed away, and seeing the miracles that Jesus has done, she says to him, "If you had been here, this wouldn't have happened." Do you think it was a rebuke of Jesus, or do you think it was just a pleading with Jesus that something might good come out of this? Any comments on that? I know when I first read it, I thought, wow, she's saying, if you had been here quicker, this wouldn't have happened. Rick?
Well, I think whenever anyone loses a loved one, they look at all the things that could have happened differently that would have kept that from happening.
Right.
I think that's just her way of expressing grief. If you had been here, this wouldn't have happened. You would have healed.
Right.
I think it's kind of her point, but
right.
Since you weren't, he died.
Right.
She's not blaming him, I don't think. She's just kind of throwing that out there.
So. Yeah, I don't think she was rebuking him at all, but again, I think she trusted in his healing powers. And she says, if you had been here, you wouldn't die. But even now, if you pray to God, God will give you what you ask. So maybe she was thinking, you may not be able to raise him from the dead, but God might. And then when Jesus says, your brother shall rise again. And again, going to Jesus' teaching, speaking about the last day and, those that will be raised anew in the resurrection on the last day. She says, "Yes, I understand that, but I understand he's going to be raised on the last day." But then Jesus says something very profound. And it's another one of the great, in this gospel, 7 times he says, "I am." And he says, "I am the resurrection and the life. And he who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. And do you believe this?" And it's interesting on Martha's response here. She says, "Yes." She says to him, "Yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." And that's exactly what Matthew records for us when Jesus says, "Who do people say that I am?" Some say you're John the Baptist, some say you're, you know, Elijah, one of the prophets of old. And Jesus asks him, he says, but who do you say that I am? And Peter says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that's what Martha's come to realize now, is that, yes, you are the Christ. You are God's Son, and you have come into this world. I'm going to read a little further. And when she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she arose quickly and came to him. Now we see that Mary is still in the house with all the mourners and all. And I read a little bit here where it says about people that that Jewish oral tradition, according to Jewish oral tradition, the funeral custom indicated that even a poor family must hire at least two flute players and a professional wailing woman to mourn their dead. But because this family, and it kind of indicates that Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were kind of a upscale, they were a little bit more well-to-do. And of course, living so close to Jerusalem, there was a large group of people here that were had come to help mourn the loss of their brother. And so I'm going to read starting in verse 30. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha met him. The Jews then who were with her in the house and consoling her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Therefore, when Mary came to where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled, and said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come see. Jesus wept. And so when the Jews, and so the Jews were saying, behold how he loved him. But some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of him who was blind have kept this man from dying also? So again, people, the Jews there had seen Jesus open the eyes of someone born blind. I want to go back and look at Jesus was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled. And of course, you know, many people have looked at verse 35, the shortest verse in the Bible, you know, Jesus wept. We talked about, you know, people that have lost loved ones and the pain, separation, and how we react to it. What do you suppose here, Jesus being troubled, grieved? I mean, he is God in the flesh. He's going to raise Lazarus. But it says he was grieved and deeply troubled in spirit. Any comments on that? Any feeling on that in particular? Yes, Les.
I think most of us have experienced, if you go to a funeral, even though it may not be someone that you're personally close to, when you see other people mourning and crying and expressing love and affection for the person who's died, you get very, I mean, humans generally are, you can watch a movie that's not even real and cry,
and be moved
by it, even though it's fiction. So I think possibly Jesus is recognizing that the emotions of his own humanity and those around him, Mary and Martha and the others who are mourning Lazarus' death, he is being called up and moved by the circumstances like anybody would.
Right.
In other words, it's not necessary. He knows what's going to happen, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He knows he's going to raise Lazarus. So for him, there isn't as much reason to mourn or to cry, but he sees them crying and recognizes the kind of permanence of death to them. And because of that, he is moved by it, because he's a human too, in this form. He's both human and God. And so I think we see the humanity of Jesus coming out here.
I agree. In looking at this, and I was, when I first read it many, many years ago, and I couldn't understand, you know, why Jesus would weep. And again, we know he's God in the flesh, but he got hungry, he got thirsty, he got tired, he got angry, did not sin, but he got angry. And so we see he has all the emotions that we have ourselves. And then as I grew as a Christian, I started thinking, wow, he probably was thinking, you know, I'm going to raise my friend. I'm going to bring him back from where he's at now to life, only to die again in the flesh. But I found something kind of interesting. The Greek word groaned in the spirit. It says he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. All right, the phrase here does not mean merely that Jesus was deeply touched or moved with sympathy at the sight. The Greek term groan always suggests anger, outrage, or emotional indignation. And we find that in Matthew and also in Mark, it talks about indignation. Most likely, Jesus was angered at the emotional grief of people because it implicitly reveals unbelief in the resurrection and the temporary nature of death. The group was acting like pagans who had no hope. And if, over in 1 Timothy or in 1 Thessalonians, it talks about those of the world that die. They die without hope. But we as believers, we have hope. While grief is understandable, the group was acting in despair, thus indicating a tactic denial of the resurrection and the scriptures that promised it. Jesus also may have been angered because he was indignant at the pain and sorrow and death that sin brought into the human condition. Jesus wept. The Greek word here has a connotation of silently bursting into tears, in contrast to the loud lament of the group. His tears here were not generated out of mourning, since he was about to raise Lazarus, but out of grief for a fallen world entangled in sin-caused sorrow and death. For we know that Jesus was a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. And so when I read that, I thought, that makes a lot more sense to me. I mean, when we look at what sin causes, yes, it causes death. You know, God told Adam, the day in which you eat of the forbidden fruit, you're going to die. But we know that Adam didn't die that day. But by disobeying God, it brought about death, physical death and spiritual death. And this is what I've come to realize as a Christian. When we lose a loved one, if we've known that loved one's life, the life that they live, and has been faithful, we should rejoice because they've gone on to be with the Lord. They've gone on to be in paradise awaiting the judgment. No more to be tired or hungry, to feel sorrow, to feel pain, to feel despair. All of those things are gone now, and they're at peace. And oftentimes when we do, yes, we miss that person's presence. We talked about Philip Mullins' father passing away and Brian's father passing away. And you miss that person. You miss that conversation you had with them, that fellowship you had with them. But if they lived a faithful life, we should rejoice. We should be happy. And looking here, seeing how the death of their brother has caused sorrow, and the friends of the family that were lamenting, they were wailing that a loved one is gone. I could see where Jesus would look at that and say, this is what caused it though. It was the sin. And Satan, how he's so deceptive in how he causes illness and disease, and then ultimately death. And if you don't have that faith, that belief in Jesus Christ, then you are just like the pagans. You just, you know, when someone dies, that's it. You'll never see them again. But us who believe, and have loved ones that have died in the faith, we know one day we're going to see that loved one again. And I think that it's cause for joy. And yes, we're sorry that they're gone, but we're happy. We rejoice silently because we know they're in a better place. And they're going to be with, we pray, we live faithful, that we'll see them once again in the kingdom of God. Don't mean to go too long on that. But now we're going to look at Jesus as he prepares to work the miracle here. Study now the miracle itself. Starting in verse 38. Jesus, therefore, again, being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now, it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. And I did a little research on caves in that area, and the scriptures kind of give us a fair indication of that. This cave, which is very common in that area, let me see if I get my notes here. I'm going far ahead of myself. Yes. No. Okay. This cave was usually, it was dug out of the side, and it was big enough that they could place more than just one body in there. And sometimes there were shelves dug out, or there were shelves constructed in there that would allow for other family members to be put in there. I cannot find what I had wrote down here. Here it is. The tomb. Okay, the tomb means a stone sepulcher. In Israel, such a grave was common. It was either a cave or a rock area, which would have been hewn out. The floor inside would have been leveled and graded to make a shallow descent. Shells were cut out or constructed inside the area in order to bury additional family members. A rock was rolled in front to prevent wild animals or grave robbers from entering. John makes mention of the fourth day, that he had been dead 4 days. This is in order to emphasize the magnitude of the miracle. For the Jews did not embalm then. What they did was they would have just, they would have wrapped the body, and I'm going to go over that also, how they did this. And so the body would have been in a state of rapid decomposition. All right, the Jews use aromatic spices, and their custom was not to embalm the body like the Egyptians did, but to use spices to counteract the repulsive odors of decomposition. They would have wrapped the body in linen, a linen cloth, adding spice in the layers and folds. The Jews did not wrap the body tightly like Egyptian mummies, but rather loosely with the head wrapped separately. This is indicated by the fact that Lazarus could move out of the tomb before he was unwrapped. So just a little understanding that he wasn't wrapped tight like a mummy was, but it was loosely wrapped, and he was laid in there. Verse 39, Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" And so they removed the stone. And Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank thee that you did hear me, and I knew that you hear me always. But because of the people standing around, I said it, that they may believe that you did send me." And when he had said this, and when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Any comments on what Jesus was, what he says here? It wasn't a petition for God to raise him. But what he says is that you hear me, and I know that you hear me. But because of the people standing around, I said this, that they may believe that you did send me. John in writing this, and we go to chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, when John says at the end of his gospel, you know, many more things that Jesus had done, but these things were written so that you may believe. And it's the same thing here. He's telling the people standing around, he's praying to his Father, Jesus is going to raise Lazarus. But he says it so that they would know that he is the Son of God, that he is the Christ, the Messiah that has come into the world. And so when he has said these things, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Any comments on what Jesus has done here and the purpose of doing it? Yes, Rick.
I remember somebody once saying that if he had not called Lazarus by name, then all those who had died from the beginning on would have come out of the tomb.
I don't know about that. I don't know. I would think.
Well, I don't necessarily. But, yeah. I think Jesus could have resurrected whoever he wanted.
Right.
That's the point. That's the power of God. I think is the point the person was making.
Right.
That he called Lazarus by name. And when we think about that, if he can raise Lazarus from the dead,
right.
He can raise anyone. And he wasn't raising Lazarus because he was righteous.
Right.
You know, he was raising Lazarus to, you know, to die again at this point. So that's the only point, I think.
Exactly. And I know in one of the scriptures, and I don't know if it's Matthew, when Jesus died on the cross, gave up the spirit, that there was an earthquake and several of believers were out of the tomb, walked about, who had died. So, Jesus could raise anyone, and he spoke the world into existence. So, he who could speak the world into existence could give life to anything. And, you know, there again, talking about the tomb in which Lazarus was at, we're not told if there were any other members of the family that had died and were buried in there too. So maybe that's the reason why someone would say that's why he had to call him by name. Yes, Les.
Well, I'm just thinking that so many times when Jesus has a situation where there's, in it like this, a lot of people, you know, the mourners or a procession has come out with Mary and Martha. And when you think about what the implications are for Jesus saying this, Lazarus, come forth, what if he doesn't come forth? After he makes this absolute statement that everybody hears. In other words, the commitment and the assurance, the confidence, the absolute knowledge that Jesus is going, or Lazarus is going to come forth, is so certain and so sure with Jesus that he can make that statement, because anybody else making it, Lazarus wouldn't come forth, and their credibility, you know, would simply diminish into nothing immediately. But that never happened with Jesus.
Right.
Never. Whatever he said happened. And this is another case in point of that.
Absolutely. You know, and anytime he healed someone, to the lepers, you know, you're cleansed. But go and show yourself and you know, give an offering. And the man who had the withered hand, you know, stretch forth your hand. The woman who was bent over, you know, your faith has made you well, and you know, your sins are forgiven you. Again, I go to what we have recorded. You know, God spoke the world into existence. You know, God, when he speaks, things happen. And same thing with Jesus. Anytime he said something, it came true. It came to pass. God is not restricted by space, travel, or, you know, or time or anything like that. So very good point. I agree. A couple of passages here. We have enough time that we can go get started going into the result or the what happens because he raises Lazarus. In verse 45, many therefore of the Jews who had come to Mary and beheld what he had done believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. And it seems like that's always a recurring thing, that there are those that see the miracles of Jesus Christ and believe, and then there's those that, even though they believe in the miracles, would not confess Jesus as being the Christ, as being the Son of God. And we have recorded for us, because they love the approval of men rather than the approval of God. But here, they go off and they tell the Jews, some went away to the Pharisees and told them the things that happened. What happens because of this? Does anybody, we're going to read here in a minute, but anybody remember what happens now? Because the Pharisees now know that look what he's doing. Look at all the signs and the wonders that he's causing. And it's causing people to believe. And like before, this animosity just starts to grow. And it gets more and more stronger and stronger. We have to destroy this man. We have to destroy his influence over the people, because the people are going to him. Let's read a little further on. Verse 47. Therefore the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council, and they were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." Stop right there. Again, there are some that no matter what, how God has prepared a way for man to have a right relationship with him, once again, people only see in the physical, in the flesh, what's in it for me? How can I benefit from this? Instead of seeing beyond that and recognizing, like what Jesus has been saying about the Spirit, what does it gain a man if he gained the whole world and lose his soul? What profits a man? What would he give in exchange for his soul? And far too often, just like the rich young ruler, you know, they want to keep their riches. They don't want to give up what they have in this life for eternity. And maybe it's just that they just couldn't see eternity. But that's why Jesus came. We got just a minute or two. I just want to read what Caiaphas says here. It says, "But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation should not perish.' Now this he did not say on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but that he might also gather together into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him." And again, Caiaphas, yes, Neil.
Go ahead and finish your...
Oh, I was just going to say, again, Caiaphas, you know, hating Jesus and saying, you know what, in order for us to keep our social status here and our independent little nation here, it's expedient for one person to die. So this person should die so we don't have what we have here taken away by the Romans. But God used it as, you know, yes, you're prophesying because you're a high priest, but your prophecies, even though it's blasphemy against Jesus, it's going to come to pass because Jesus is going to die for all.
Well, the concern that the Romans would come and take away their place and their nation, they wanted to attribute that to Christ's teachings. And in a sense, that was so.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't because of Christianity that Rome destroyed Jerusalem. It was because the need for the Jewish nation had been fulfilled. And it was time then to move on from the Jewish people to the entire world, and to open, you know, with Christianity. So their own behavior led to giving Rome the reason to destroy the Jewish nation in its finality. we have folks today who are of Jewish descent, and if they are a political nation, but they are not the same nation, because they don't have the same laws, they don't have the same
right
way of doing things. And but the, you know, their prediction there was true, but it wasn't because of Jesus's direct action, but because of his very presence at that point in time. What they were saying might happen, and we've got to end this, is it's going to happen, and there's nothing you can do to end this.
Right. And you're right, that's why it came to destruction in AD 70, and you're right, that's God's, that was God's plan. There's no longer going to be the temple and the keeping of the laws of Moses. You know, we see the keeping of the Ten Commandments. We see that for Christians today. I mean, you know, we're to keep, we're, you know, to do the things that, that are written in God's law. But you're right, that form of worship was going to be done away with. It was fulfilled in Christ. And Christ has torn down that partition that once separated Jews from Gentiles. And now Jesus, you know, he is the sacrificial lamb for all of mankind, whether, you know, Greek or Jews. And it is, it's sad that, that there are those today of the Jewish faith that, you know, have Jews and still rely back on that. And I've worked with some people that are Jewish, and they do, they say, well, yes, we have to, you know, we obey, you know, the laws, you know, in the temple and in their synagogue and everything. But they really feel just because they have Jewish blood, they have a reserved seat in heaven. And it's sad that they adhere to that thinking, because I always say, well, what about Jesus, you know, and the things that are written about Jesus. Now, we don't believe that. We don't believe that he was the Messiah, he was the Christ. And there's no one else in history that Scripture can point, or that anything can point to, that fulfilled all that what Jesus did. And, you know, we know that what Paul writes in Romans, Jesus at the right time died for all of mankind. It was a perfect time in world history for someone like that to give up, to give his life. I mean, Jesus fulfilled all prophecy. So, yeah, it's a shame that, that there are those today that still cling to this, the nation of Israel, you know. I'm glad they're our ally in the Middle East, but it's about as far as it goes. But anyway, thank you very much for your comments. I greatly appreciate that. I hope this lesson has been beneficial and edifying to you all.